The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and to check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week is Stephen Capsudo, whose book Alternate Channels documents the history of queer images on television across the 20th century. An updated edition was released last year, and it's absolutely vital reading for anyone interested in LGBTQ culture, which I suspect is you. Stephen's work as a historian began as a personal project, videotaping gay episodes of TV in the 80s because it helped him feel less alone. But before long, that personal project turned into a vital record. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on June 6th at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And by the way, if you like nerdy queer podcasts, you may enjoy my narrative comedy shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends for an escape into a world of fantasy, with drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. You can subscribe to both shows at queensofadventure.com or search your favorite podcast app. Now, here's Stephen. Well, this week I'm speaking to media historian, author of Alternate Channels, Queer Images on 20th Century Television, Stephen Capsudo. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for the invite, Matt.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
There's so many choices, but I think probably what formed me most as a kid, I grew up in the early 70s, and all those Norman Lear sitcoms, especially All in the Family, that was my education about the world and about politics and about social justice movements. It was an era before the internet. And if you were a kid who maybe was, you know, just starting to read, television was your window into the world, television and radio. And so it was an exciting time to be a kid because television was just like changing. Like when I was really little, sitcoms were like, you know, the Brady Bunch and the Beverly Hillbillies, what I think the producer Norman Lear once referred to as stories about happy white people with happy white problems. You know, will the teenage son, you know, find a girl to go to the dance with him? That was the big dilemma. And then All in the Family came along and suddenly it was, you know, racism and homophobia and substance abuse and, you know, sexism and how were people challenging those things and how did it affect families? And so it was an exciting time to be, you know, coming of age or starting to come of age in American popular culture.
Did those issues, like very political concerns, like did that feel relevant to like a kid who was growing up in the middle of them?
It sort of did. I mean, I was a weird kid. When I was really little, like 3, 4, 5 years old, I was watching kids shows. I loved the local kids shows in Philadelphia, which were wonderful. And I loved, you know, the sort of less intellectual shows like I Dream of Jeannie and My Favorite Martian. But I was also, and thinking back at the time, it didn't seem weird to me, but thinking back, I remember being 4 and 5 years old and watching local public affairs shows about the Black Civil Rights Movement. And in hindsight, you know, I only started thinking about this like last week when somebody else was interviewing me. Why would, you know, this 5-year-old white Jewish kid from an affluent suburb in New Jersey be watching this? And I think it's that I had an awareness that in my grandparents' generation, there were people who had come to the U.S. fleeing from anti-Semitism, from countries where Jews were like the bottom of the pile and you could do anything to a Jew and it didn't matter because their lives didn't matter. And I think there was something exciting to me about the fact that there was a similarly oppressed, I mean, the specifics are different, obviously, but a very oppressed minority in my country that was fighting back, that was finding ways to get the beginnings of change. And I just thought that was really kind of exciting, even though I didn't understand a word they were talking about. But I was watching these shows fascinated.
Wow, that is an interesting way of looking at it. That I guess you're recognizing intersectionality essentially there.
I don't think it got that sophisticated because I was sure, like, you know, a kindergartner. But just that I knew that the people in my family had to leave where they lived because they didn't see any hope of safety where they were. There was no hope of justice, and that there were people finding ways, that there were techniques for fighting that, really intrigued me. And then, of course, later when I came out, between that and the Norman Lear sitcoms and watching other, you know, things in the culture, and hearing my parents talk about politics and so on, I think I just had this idea from a very early age that when there's injustice, that the way you address it is through political organizing, and that that change is possible, even though it can take a really long time to achieve.
How much was like activism a part of your life growing up? Like, was it like something that you actively did, or?
No. I mean, we did, you know, more charity stuff. Yeah. You know, walkathons for cystic fibrosis and that sort of thing, but not activism. And my, even though my parents followed politics, and I remember, you know, watching the Republican and Democratic conventions when I was like, you know, starting at age 7 and, you know, talking about these things. My parents aren't really joiners. They're wonderful people, and they care a lot about, you know, a lot of issues, but they're not so much hands-on. They're more having conversations with people about issues, friends and family and things, but they're not, you know, a get out in the streets and, you know, picket or, you know, lay down on a bridge or something. That's not their style.
But was a conversation, you clearly were aware that there was like a history of injustice and flight from oppressors and that kind of thing. Like, was that, how much of that was a conversation growing up?
Well, you know, growing up in a largely Jewish town, not hugely long after World War II, there were certainly Holocaust survivors and children of Holocaust survivors in the neighborhood. Our school system had a real focus on social injustice, and it was the 70s also. So that was, you know, in the air, social change movements. So so in our school, we studied, you know, the history of the Black Civil Rights Movement. We studied the ways in which Native tribes had been treated in this country. We read about and watched films about, for example, the people who had tried to stand up against the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II. We studied all those things. We studied the Holocaust. And most importantly, and I've thought a lot about this in the last few years under the current, you know, presidency, I think, again, because there were so many Jewish people and so many people who had ties to the Holocaust, we didn't just study what Hitler did when he got into power, what Mussolini did when he got into power. We studied what the rise of authoritarianism looks like. Not just, I think in the U.S., mostly people study what authoritarians do once they're in power. And I think that's something that sort of happened in the last election, is there were so many people who didn't recognize the techniques that were being used as what the rise of authoritarianism or aspiring authoritarianism looks like. And so, yeah, coming out of that school district and that community and, you know, knowing some of my family history, all of that was in place. And then when I came out and realized, you know, that gay people were in sort of on the bottom rung in many ways in this country, sharing that bottom rung with many other groups, my first thought was, okay, how do we change this?
Mm. Well, so, I mean, what's the answer to that? When you, especially when you have sort of a model kind of in the TV that you're seeing, like on those Norman Lear shows, I guess it sort of shows you a crucible of different ideas coming together and reaching some sort of resolution sometimes. Did you feel like you had an obligation or an active role to take in changing the world?
A little bit. I mean, certainly when I got to college, I got involved with gay activist movements and, you know, anything from stuffing envelopes to lobbying to trying to raise awareness on campus. I mean, it was a very, very different time. I'm 56 years old, so I was born in 1964. When I was born, homosexuality was a crime in every U.S. state but Illinois, and Illinois had just decriminalized it. Like, you could go to jail. And it was, you know, and it was on the books as a mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so when you came before a judge, the judge could then order you to be confined in a mental hospital. I mean, there was just like all these horrible things that could happen to you. And as a result, as a matter of self-protection, people weren't out of the closet on the whole, which meant not only were we largely invisible to the mainstream population, except if we had committed a terrible crime, because you know, as the folks at GLAAD used to say, you know, in the American news media, if you are a homosexual philanthropist, they just call you a philanthropist. Mm-hmm. If you're a homosexual serial killer, they call you a gay serial killer, right? Mm-hmm. So the good people were thought to deserve privacy and the bad people. So our visibility sucked, and it meant that we were invisible to each other, which for a kid is a terrible thing. You know, I felt like, you know, that guy on the character on League of Gentlemen who thinks he's the only gay in the village, right? I could well have been the only gay person in New Jersey for all I knew up to age 11. And really what changed that was just a couple of little pieces of information that came my way that sort of helped keep me together emotionally and to know that I wasn't the only one. In sixth grade, we had a, you know, they do a very cursory sex ed thing in sixth grade where usually the school nurse takes the girls into one room for 40-minute sessions over the course of a week. And they talk about, you know, feminine hygiene and periods and so on. Mm-hmm. And then they have to do something with the boys. So usually a male gym teacher, or in our case, one of the sixth grade male teachers, takes the boys into another room and does what I think teachers refer to as the plumbing lecture, which is, you know, about anatomy and lots of stuff about heterosexuality. And at the end of this, the fifth day, the fifth 40-minute section, the teacher said, does anybody, you know, have any questions about things that we didn't discuss? And this one boy raised his hand and said, yeah, what's a faggot? And the teacher, completely calm, said, well, you know, the correct word is homosexual. And we've discussed that usually men are attracted to women and women are attracted to men. But there are some people attracted to the same sex and they're called homosexuals. And that was as detailed as the explanation got. But what it told me was that there's a word for it. And if there's a word for it, I can't be the only one. There wouldn't be a word for it if I were the only one. And so
really,
sort of that.
Like, had you never seen any discussion of it, like on TV or in the media? Like there's just nothing?
No, there was very, very little. And if there had been, I probably didn't understand it. I think I was about 11 the first time I remember any kind of discussion in the media. Hmm. And that's probably a good thing, because looking back, for the people who were like 4 years older than me, 5 years older than me, the media images were pretty damn terrifying. You know, it was like the era when gay people were just trying to get their rights, get decriminalization and anti-discrimination laws. Mm-hmm. And pretty much every, not just gay and lesbian, any sexual minority character at all on a TV drama usually was a serial killer or a child molester or a terrorist. So I was very lucky that if I saw any of that, I didn't understand it. And then what happened was in the 70s, organizations like the Gay Activists Alliance and, as it then was, the National Gay Task Force made media activism a priority, saying, you know, if we're trying to get our rights and all the public is seeing are these terrifying images of us, that's not a good thing. And so by the time I was paying attention, I really connected the idea that I was gay when I was 11. By then, the media images had become like so squeaky clean, the characters hardly seemed human, but that's probably what I needed. And, and Phil Donahue's daytime talk show would have gay people on and some of the other. So I was coming out to myself, at least, at just the right moment.
What did you feel about like coming out? Like, was it a scary experience, or were there things that were exciting to you about finally being able to say something out loud and be part of some other thing that other people were also experiencing?
So what I knew, and you talk about getting like subliminal cues from the culture, like I had never had a discussion with anybody about homosexuality other than that one statement by our sixth grade teacher. But I knew that I could never, ever, ever tell anybody, because if one person knew, then other people could find out and horrible things could happen to me. Like you could be killed, right? I mean, there's still violence, but more so then, or go to jail or whatever. And so I just decided I'm never going to tell anybody. Hmm. And that lasted until I was about 20. So that's 9 years of knowing I was gay, but it wasn't safe. And intervening in that period, other things happened. I was bar mitzvahed in 1977. I had a great uncle, my grandfather's brother, who was born in 1915, had come out to the family in the 1940s or 50s, when that was a really kind of ballsy thing to do. And he brought his boyfriend to my bar mitzvah, which I guess meant he had asked my parents, and they had said it was okay and sent the invitation to, you know, Eddie Capsudo and guest. And so that sort of let me know that there were some people in the family who were going to be okay. Maybe not initially, but eventually they would be okay. There was a point of reference for it. But still, I was determined not to let anybody know. And it was really when I was about 20 that I remember I was, I was a student at Rutgers. I was walking to the Douglas Dining Hall. I still remember exactly where I was when I had this thought. And I pictured myself as a 70-year-old man looking back on my life. And I asked myself, what would I regret more? Would I regret more having never told anybody and never having had a relationship and never being honest with anybody? Or would I have regretted anything that might have happened as a result of people knowing I was gay? And that was the moment when I decided, I need to be out. And, I got active in the gay student group at Rutgers, which is, I think, the second oldest gay student group in the country. Only after Columbia. It was founded in 69, I think. Mm-hmm. And started a few years later when my family is not always the cutting edge adopters of technology. We got a color TV in the 80s, and around the same time we got a VCR in the late 80s. So I started frantically recording anything I could find about anything LGBT. So I've been collecting these videos since 1987, 33 years. And around 89, when I was in grad school, I was volunteering with an LGBT crisis hotline in Philadelphia. And we would get a lot of calls from, again, this is the era when people are not out and the images that are out there weren't always great. We would get a lot of calls from lesbian and gay teenagers saying, I think I'm probably gay and I'm thinking of killing myself. And when we would talk with them about what they thought gay people's lives were like, what they thought they were, quote unquote, doomed to, I always got the same response, pretty much verbatim, which was, I only know what you see on television. Hmm. And I talked to some of the other counselors and they were getting the same answer. And then I looked through the logbook and it seemed like every call from a potentially suicidal gay teen included that sentence. And it surprised me because, for me, there had been in that late 70s period around the time of sort of the backlash against Anita Bryant and all that, so many relatively reassuring images, that I saw gay adults either on talk shows or as fictional characters who had lives, who had friends, whose family talked to them, who in some cases had a partner. And who had careers and, there was potential for a happy life, which was something that had been largely invisible from the culture before that. And apparently by the late 80s, when I was at this crisis hotline, those hopeful images had disappeared again. And I think a lot of that had to do with the AIDS crisis sort of, weakening the gay rights movement. A lot of people died. A lot of people had to refocus their energy away from specifically gay rights to this more life and death situation. And not just gay men. A lot of lesbians and bi women were very hands-on in activism and caring for friends and so on. And so the media activism piece died in the 80s. And I thought, I could write a series of articles. At first I thought, maybe it's a book, but I don't think I'm going to find enough information because TV likes to pretend we don't exist. What is there to write about? So I started doing research for what I thought would be three newspaper articles that I would try to, sell as a series to some gay papers. And I was working an office job near the main Free Library of Philadelphia. So every day at lunchtime, I would spend 40 minutes in the microfilm and newspapers rooms, adding information to my research database, shows I didn't know about and things that had happened behind the scenes. And 11 years later, I had a 500-page book.
I'm so curious about the basically the archiving that you were doing just on your own at first. It sounds like when you had that VCR, you're just like taping whatever you happen to find. So what was, what was in your collection to start?
So what I started with was I created a spreadsheet on a laptop computer. And every day I would go to the library, and of course there were basically no research databases. You were looking through either the print volumes of the annual edition of the New York Times Index or the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature. And so I would look up I started with 1926, which was the beginning of network radio broadcasting, and I went through year by year through every index they had, looking for anything about anything that was under, depending on the decade, homosexuality, perversion, homosexual, whatever, you know, transsexuality, all those older terms, and looking for articles and adding. So that's how I found out about shows I didn't know about, going pretty far back. And then I started every week, I would buy TV Guide and I would go through every entry looking for what shows were being rerun. So I knew the premiere of NYPD in 1967 was like the first portrayal of like an out and proud gay character who was an activist. And I saw that the Nostalgia Channel was rerunning that five nights a week. So I had one VCR in one room that was taping, you know, reruns of NYPD every night until I got the episode I wanted. And, you know, Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law, and all the other shows I knew about but couldn't find. And then I would read the descriptions for the current shows, looking for any hints. And, you know, and the hints were often, you know, you had to sort of like translate. So like there was a 1998 episode of Chicago Hope, which is about a little trans girl who's being beaten at school and threatened by the mom's boyfriend. And unfortunately, I didn't notice the little entry on that until after it had aired, and it took me until last year to find the episode. But but what it actually said was, you know, Dr. Hancock treats a little girl who thinks she's a boy. So you have to like sort of like read between the lines and say, okay, that's a trans story. I need to find that episode, you know, that sort of thing.
How did you find one of the pieces of your book that is so interesting to me is Lady in the Dark from 1947, radio broadcast of a Moss Hart play. Maybe like this is like you just don't remember how it came to you. But like there's just the most fleeting reference to a character who's a bit like coded mincing.
He's not. What's amazing about that is he's not coded at all. He's this gay fashion photographer, and in the scene in the play and in the radio version and in the TV version where he's played by I can picture him, I'm blanking on his name now. They allowed the character to be specifically gay. He is taking photos of this sort of hunky Hollywood star who's a character in the play. And all the women in the office are, you know, all a titter over, oh, Randy Curtis is in the studio. And then this gay photographer, Russell, comes, you know, speeding in. I think on Broadway he was played with by Danny Kaye, all wrists and ascots and whatnot. And he's gushing with them. I've photographed gorgeous men before, but he's quite the hunk of man, Liza. I could just eat him up, you know, or something like that. And the reason it was allowed was it was a broadcast of the Theater Guild on the air, which was very prestigious. And the sponsor, the United States Steel Company, was willing to allow them a lot of leeway that other shows could not have. And I knew about that because around, 1976 or 77, I had discovered the old time radio recordings at our public library. They had a bunch of LPs and cassettes, and I just became fascinated with this sort of back history of television. You know, when radio had been where the Westerns and cop shows and medical dramas and soaps and sitcoms had been. And so I had quite a collection, and I was also very interested in the history of theater. I did a lot of community theater when I was a teenager and student productions. And so when I discovered that a bunch of episodes of Theater Guild on the Air survived, I just like, you know, tracked them down, and I happened to hear Lady in the Dark. And then years later, when I was working on this book, I remembered, oh yeah, Lady in the Dark was done on radio at least three times. And so I went and re-listened to the episode and said, yeah, this needs to be in there.
When you showed people the collection that you were putting together, did you have other people who were like, oh my God, this is amazing, this is fascinating, let's watch this together? Or was it more solitary?
Yeah,
okay.
It was, well, part of it was the nature of television. Television was very ephemeral. If you didn't see something when it aired, you just didn't see it, right? And so, you know, VCRs they existed in the 70s, but people didn't really have them in large numbers till close to the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And so, and people, particularly gay people and bi people, were hungry for images of gay and bi people on the air. Trans people were also, but the images weren't there to be hungry for, right? There was very, very little. And so when I was a student in grad school, I would put together video nights for the LGB student group. And we would watch, you know, an episode of The Golden Girls and an episode of Barney Miller and, you know, maybe one other show. And then I, in 1990, I saw Vito Russo, who wrote the groundbreaking book, The Celluloid Closet, about gay images in cinema. Mm. I saw him give his Celluloid Closet lecture about 6 months before he died.
Oh, wow.
And, this was March and he died in November. I think he died watching the election results.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
And, you know, Vito was this amazing guy who had been in the original Gay Activists Alliance. He had been, you know, just this tremendous both historian, media collector, and activist. And I loved the format of his lecture. He came in with about 55 minutes of movie clips, starting with the silent era and going up to, you know, the 80s. And he would use that as a window to talk about how our status in society had changed, using movies as sort of the jumping off point for those conversations and talking about what had happened behind the scenes in the movie studios that allowed these images to evolve. And I thought, well, you know, at that point I was about 6 months into drafting this book and researching the book. And I thought, I could do a talk exactly like this, but television. And so I started doing the lecture in 90.
Where did you do it?
Oh, I wrote to colleges. And I think the first one I did was at the Northeast Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual Student Union Conference in Boston in 1990. And then I traveled all over the country. I was doing like 6-7 lectures a year. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I did the talk. I did a few talks in the UK, a couple in Spain. My main job is as a translator. And so I've done the talk in Spain about 6 times in Spanish with, you know, a mix of dubbed and subtitled clips. And that's always fun because you get the outsider perspective on your own culture, mm. You know.
Were there pieces of your collection that were your favorites?
Yeah, I mean, some because they're terrible. I'm told that the chapter that sold the book to Random House was the chapter about the Killer Dykes episode of Police Woman from 1974. Mm. And so that episode, which is just so horrific, just has a special place in my heart. And it's about this the episode is called The Flowers of Evil. And it's about this gang of killer lesbians who run a nursing home for old people, rich old people. And they, you know, get the old people to sign over their belongings and they steal the people's money and then they strangle them. So you have these, you know, this sort of nasty, growling butch lesbian, you know, strangling this media archetype of a sweet old lady. You know, that's and that pretty much was what the image of lesbians on TV was in the mid-70s, was, you know, either killers or corpses. And if they were corpses, often they had been killed by another lesbian. So you can sort of see where the media activism needed to happen. So I love that. But later, by the 90s, I really liked the character of Carter on Spin City because he was – they never soft-pedaled the fact that he was gay. They didn't depoliticize him. They didn't desexualize him. And that was rare at the time. You know, that he was a full-fledged member of the cast. He wasn't like the gay neighbor down the hall who's there for local color, or he's not, as it was on Friends, you know, the main character's lesbian ex-wife who turns up every so often. No, this was a central character on the show. So I thought that was really cool. And then more recently, like the last few years, what I find very exciting is shows where you have queer people in the writer's room, right? And in charge of production. So you have a show like, you know, Pose, which, yeah, Ryan Murphy created it and he wrote the first couple of episodes. But once he steps aside and you have trans women of color writing the stories of trans women of color, it becomes really solid. And you get stories that you haven't seen before. Or like a show like Sense8 on Netflix, where, you know, it's created, co-created and co-produced by the Wachowskis, who are two trans women. And there were other queer people in the writing room. And you have this whole panoply of, you know, there's the lesbian couple where one's a cis woman and one's a trans woman. And they're, you know, and the trans woman is the star of her own life. You know, she's, again, not there as a complication in someone else's life. And so I think this is an exciting time where you have queer people writing their own experiences or imagining, you know, other queer people's experiences.
Did you have particular characters that that really felt like you identified with them? I know you mentioned Carter, who's one of my favorites as well, who's, you know, like wonderfully aspirational because he's so smart and moral in this environment where people are terrible. Did you have like role model characters that you felt really proud to associate with?
I don't know about role models, because when I needed role models, they sort of weren't there, right? We're talking about characters like when I was, you know, in my 20s or 30s already. I can tell you a character that I found very relatable. There was a Fox TV movie in, I think, 92 called Doing Time on Maple Drive. And it's about these very controlling parents who demand absolute perfection from their kids. And, yes. And it sort of explores the destructive impact that has. The one son becomes alcoholic and the daughter, I forget what happens with her. And then there's the younger son who's in college and, you know, just cannot tell his family he's gay. Well, that wasn't my own experience, but that was one of the first times I saw an LGBT character on TV who reminded me of LGBT people I knew. I thought, I know this guy. And that was really kind of exciting to have that resonance of recognition, because usually what you saw was some straight person's fantasy of what gay people were like that had then been watered down further by network censors. And so this was different.
Am I remembering correctly that is Jim Carrey in that one?
Yeah, he plays the son with the drinking problem.
Mm.
And he's a very good dramatic actor. People know him for, you know, comedy, but he's very good in that.
Yeah, there's a real power to as weird as that casting decision seems to us now, but there's a real power to seeing somebody who feels like a, you know, sort of an everyman, as I think he would have in, like, what was it, 90 or 87-ish?
I think the film's from 92 or 93.
Oh, okay. Was there like a lot of conversation around that movie when it happened?
I think so. You know, when I would do my lectures, so that's about 2 or 3 years into my doing the lectures, at the end, I was speaking to undergraduate groups, and I would ask people two questions. I would say, when was the first time you knew that gay people existed? And that was interesting to hear the answers of. And the other was, have you ever seen a character who reminded you of gay people you know? And that year, after that film came out, that was the first time I got yeses, and almost everybody mentioned that character, or they mentioned the Ryan Phillippe character on One Life to Live.
Mm. That's so interesting. Like, I think that also really places a person in time, like where they see the character that resonates with them. For me, it's you know, Will and Grace reminded me of so many of my friends. And I think that was the first time I saw, like, and I remember at the time there was the complaint about, like, well, no gay people are actually like this. And I'm like, I don't know. I think a lot of gay people are actually like this.
Yeah, I have a friend who is kind of like, if Jack were more responsible in his life, basically this friend of mine, you know, who will probably hear this interview and he will know that he's who I'm talking about, is he's kind of Jack. Yeah.
There's, you know, when I have similar conversations with people, and very seldom does someone say, like, for example, I was talking to somebody who's in their 20s, and they mentioned Christopher Isherwood, and that kind of threw me because I wasn't expecting a young person to say that. But usually, like, if you hear, like, it was Glee, or I don't know, it was, yeah, Jody on Soap, then you're like, ah, okay, I know exactly where you're coming from.
Jody was certainly the first gay regular that I remember being aware of as a gay regular. But in hindsight, there are shows I loved as a kid that nobody remembers. And what they seem to have in common is they had gay regulars on them. You know, I loved the first season of The Corner Bar. I loved Hot L Baltimore. Amazing that my parents allowed 11-year-old me to watch Hot L Baltimore, where, like, you know, two of the main characters are sex workers and two of the others are a gay male couple. And it was not, you know, your usual children's fare, but anything that Norman Lear did, we watched. So we watched that.
Can you describe that show? Because it's like almost completely erased. It's not available anywhere. And it's almost never discussed.
Yeah. So it was based on a play that had been very successful in New York. It was set in this sort of Fleabag hotel in Baltimore. It was called Hot L Baltimore because Hot L is hotel with the E burned out on the neon sign. Mm-hmm. It was that run down that they didn't bother to fix the sign. And it was this residential hotel. And there were all of these sort of social outcasts of different types who lived there. And it was an ensemble show. It had great people. Charlotte Ray was in it. And Richard Mazur is in it. It's this fan. Oh, and Conchetta Farrell plays one of the main characters who are the two sex workers. And it's horribly dated. It does not hold up well. But at the time, it was really kind of cool. And ABC was so uncomfortable with it. They had, I think it was their first Norman Lear show. CBS was used to Norman Lear. ABC was not. And they kept trying to water down the scripts. They kept postponing it and rescheduling it. And, you know, it was keeping track of when it was on was difficult, which is, I think, why it didn't do particularly well. And then stations in some cities refused to air it because they thought it was immoral. But there are this older, not older, well, my age, 50, mm-hmm. mid-50s, gay male couple who bicker a lot and in some ways fit a stereotype. The one is sort of very domineering and you know, obsessed with he's actually interesting because on the one hand, he's very sort of macho. I think he's a war veteran, but he's also, you know, obsessed with ballet and opera and, you know, that sort of stereotype of what a gay man was like. And then his partner is more timid and very accommodating of this, you know, bully that he's been in a relationship with for decades. And there's this one episode, which is the only episode that I have a recording of, where the meek character decides that he wants to go to school and take a law course and, you know, sort of better himself. And they, what they play with is the trope, and this was a big trope in 70s sitcoms, where the wife wants to go back to school and become a professional of some sort, and the husband feels threatened by it. So they played with all those tropes, but it's a gay couple.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a real shame that it's not more widely available because I haven't seen it myself. I've only just read about it, and I'm so curious about how that couple ages today.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question, and it's also, you know, it feels very much to me, looking at it now, it feels like a 70s British sitcom more than an American one. It's very stagey. It's a single set mostly, and it just kind of feels a little like Are You Being Served, in that it's like mm-hmm. it's clearly being done under hot theatrical lights and everybody is, you know, projecting to the back of the house, even though there's no reason to. And I think they were trying to recapture the feel of the stage play. And I think one or two of the cast members had been in the play so that they were, you know, sort of playing with that. Mm. And then the Corner Bar was this show also about outcasts. It was this sort of rundown bar that I think was supposed to be on Second Avenue in Manhattan. And one of the characters is this theatrical designer named Peter Panama, played by Vincent Schiavelli, who tends to introduce himself as, I think in one episode he says, "Pleased to meet you. I'm a close personal friend of Angela Lansbury's." You know, he's this very, you know, in some ways very stereotypical, but he's very likable. And you know, Vincent Schiavelli wouldn't have been the first person you would think of for that kind of role.
No.
And he's given again what, you know, what the rest of his career looked like, but he's very good in it. I finally got to see, to rewatch that as an adult last year. I went down to the Paley Center, which, you know, used to be the Museum of Television and Radio. And, they have this massive archive of obscure shows. And so my partner and I went down there when I was working on the 20th anniversary update of the book. I wanted to add photos. The original publisher didn't put in photos and I needed captions. And so I had found a promo photo of this character and we went and we watched, you know, some episodes, or actually the one episode they had. And that line was there, close personal friend of Angela Lansbury. And we're like, okay, that's the caption. And then we watched, the Nancy Walker show, which also had a gay regular. Mm. And, they had the episode that the promo shot I had was from, so I was able to quote that dialogue. So the book went from like zero photos to like, you know, 100 photos, but that meant spending a lot of time at archives looking at obscure shows to pull dialogue from.
Oh, that's very exciting. Like, I've seen little bits and pieces of those things, and it's a real shame that I think a lot of the shows that were daring enough to have queer characters before other shows did, in part, the fact that they were so daring also meant that they were either neglected in terms of promo, or they just failed to capture an audience. So a lot of those really important pieces of media just haven't made it to like streaming services today.
And a lot of them didn't have enough episodes to justify syndicated reruns, which is where shows gain their fame after, you know, after they end. The one that's really daring, and I would love to get recordings, I've seen the six episodes that they have at the Paley Center, is, again, a Norman Lear show, All That Glitters, which is the first show with a really central trans character, played, of course, by a cisgender actress, but that, you know, that this much of the story of a 65-episode series revolves around a trans woman is kind of remarkable. And when I wrote the first edition of the book, there was no way to find episodes of it. Even the Paley Center didn't have it back then. I was able to find one photo, but I couldn't find out what the what her plot lines had been. So I just, in the first edition, mention her in passing. But in the new edition, I have a photo, I have a paragraph, and you know, actually have some sense of what the character was.
Do you feel a bit like sort of a gay Indiana Jones, where you're just like combing through these like archives and antiques and trying to gather these lost antiquities? I guess there's a colonial aspect to Indiana Jones that maybe is not so great, but... That, I don't know, that you're a treasure hunter.
Kind of, well, or pack rat, depending how you look at it. But yes, some of it was when we first got our VCR in 1987, because you couldn't know when something interesting was going to air, I started just recording everything I watched. And if the show wasn't interesting, then I erased it. And so there are things that I found that, you know, now when I post, usually on Twitter, most days I post a feature called Today in Queer TV History. Mm-hmm. And usually I have clips from my collection, although often now with the quarantines, I'm not home all the time. But when I can, when I'm home, like this week, I try to post clips. And occasionally I'll post things and people will say, how did you find that? You know, I had a clip from an episode of the 50s detective show Peter Gunn. Mm. I have a guest shot by Franklin Pangborn on Ann Southern's 50s sitcom Private Secretary, where he plays and you talk about coded, but not that coded. So he's playing this sort of prissy, fussy male secretary, you know, who dresses like every 1950s cartoonist's idea of a gay man, you know, with a bowler hat and the, yes. the white gloves clutched in one hand and a flower in his lapel and a walking stick. And
it's the Pangborniest of Pangborn roles.
Oh, yes. And so he's playing this guy who is a male secretary at a time when men were not generally secretaries. And in the course of the dialogue, he mentions that his real dream was to be an interior designer, but that when you have to hang drapes, you have to climb ladders, and he bruises so easily.
Oh, God, I love it.
So I have that because Nick at Night was rerunning Private Secretary, retitled Susie, I think, and I happened to record it. And I'm like, well, that's a keeper. And that clip has been in my lectures since 1990, actually earlier, because I showed that episode, I think, in 1988 or 89 at one of the gay video nights I had done at Penn. So that's sort of been a mainstay of my lectures for a long time.
Gosh, all these things are like just hiding in, you know, if you don't happen to have the VHS tape that you recorded, like when you were lucky enough to have it, I would hope, like hiding away in, you know, VHS or not VHS, but like, you know, some sort of tape archive somewhere deep in some, you know, CBS lot or something. It makes me feel kind of crazy to know that they're out there somewhere, but locked away because there's just no financial incentive for the company to release it.
Right. Well, what was great about working on the documentary series Visible was, you know, they had Apple TV had the money to license clips, and they had a research staff. And so although a lot of the clips, I was the lead historical consultant, and I supplied a lot of the clips, but which they then, you know, went to the rights owners and tried to get better copies of. But at least that was the jumping off point. But then they found things on their own that would have been really must have been very hard to find. And they were just very, very determined over the 1 year period when they were putting that together.
Is there sort of like a holy grail, like a thing that you've been searching for or some lost piece that may never be found?
There are shows that I found mentions of in newspaper articles that I would love to see to know whether the description was accurate. There's I think Kraft Television Theater where supposedly somebody is like referring to another character being queer, and from context, it doesn't just mean eccentric, it means queer, you know, things like that I would love to find. And I would love to get some episodes of All That Glitters, which would be great. And the gay episodes of Mary Hartman and Mary Hartman, I would love to find. Mostly, I mean, the trans stuff is what's generally been hardest to find because often those episodes don't get rerun. So, for example, it took me until I think last year to find that trans girl episode of Chicago Hope, to find the two-part medical center from 1975 with William with Robert Reed just after the Brady Bunch, trying to you know get himself untypecast. And of course, the trans characters mostly were medicalized and presented as guest characters on hospital dramas. But it's important to document that history and to have the episodes. There's a dreadful sounding episode of West Side Medical, which I read the script for up at Cornell. They have the papers of the old gay media. They have the papers of the old Gay Media Task Force, which was the network's main consultant on all things, you know, queer scripts, and. There's an episode of West Side Medical from, I think, 77. The working title of the script was The Freak, which sort of tells you where were coming from. And they retitled it The Mermaid. And if I'm remembering correctly, there's this was the era when, you know, there were the rumors that a lot of the East German women athletes were either on male hormones or were actually men masquerading as women. That was like a popular thing for people to joke about. And so the premise of this episode is that this East German swimmer, a woman, is competing in the U.S. and has to go to the hospital because she's sick, and her handlers don't want her to go to the hospital. And the explanation, at least in the draft of the script that I read, is that she had been a cis male athlete who had been forced by the government to undergo sex reassignment surgery and compete as a woman.
Wow.
Now, I sincerely hope that between the Freak script and the Mermaid script, things improved. But I kind of suspect it didn't. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see what that ended up being. Because, you know, the horrible stories are important to document, too. You can't talk about change if you don't have the evidence of how bad things were.
Yeah. I remember reading in your book, actually, that there were insiders within the within the studios and within the production companies that would sometimes slip the scripts out to activists to alert them to problems that were coming up.
Very early on, yeah. Scripts, pretty much any gay-themed script, in the early 70s to mid-70s, particularly the really slanderous ones, did get snuck out to various gay activists. And that's really where the beginnings of nationalized gay activism came from, because previously there had been, you know, local groups here and there, and there had been some attempts in the 60s to create national umbrella groups like NACO, spelled Nacho but pronounced NACO, the North American Conference of Homophile Organizations. But that didn't really stick.
And I can't imagine why.
And so by the early to mid 70s, you had activists on the two coasts and, you know, some in the middle who weren't talking to each other a whole lot. Again, there was no internet, right? So there were these sort of little silos going on, and you would have the activists in New York would go to the network executives, the big honchos, and say, you know, this is terrible. Like, every portrayal is violent. No other minority group would stand for this. You need to do something about that. And what these New York activists were told by the New York executives was, well, those are creative issues. Those are all determined out in Hollywood. We have no say in that. And meanwhile, those activists didn't know that there were activists in Hollywood going to the network executives out there and being told, oh, well, that's corporate policy. We don't decide that in California. That's New York. So they were getting the runaround. And eventually, around these issues, around the two horrible Marcus Welby MD episodes, around the policewoman episode, and to some extent around the initial bad news that people had heard about soap, which initially didn't sound like it was going to be very promising, these nationalized bodies emerged, particularly actually before soap. It's more like around 73, 74, 75. And by that point, you start to have all three of the major networks at that time agreed to run all of their gay-themed scripts past gay consultants most of whom were people who had worked in the industry and had some sense of, you know, what makes a good script. And they did it, they said, for the same reason that if you were doing a TV movie about astronauts, you would run the script by an astronaut to say, is this plausible? You know, would an astronaut do this or say this?
Okay, sure. So, like, gradually we started to get a seat at the table. I mean, maybe it wasn't even a seat at the table. It was, like, sort of, like, standing at the window shouting in.
No. It was by 75, there were producers who were complaining that the Gay Media Task Force had too much power in the industry. You know, but again, the threshold for tolerating, you know, outside influence was low at the time. And it took a mixture of sort of two-pronged. When you're trying to get a seat at the table, you can't just say, give us a seat at the table, because usually nobody will. So you need a two-pronged approach. You have the people who are doing the sort of in-your-face zap action protests, like, you know, the sit-in at the NBC vice president's office as, you know, the rally was going on below, that sort of thing. The sort of action that people would later associate with ACT UP and groups like that. What that does is the networks see that there's a choice of either negotiating with the people they perceive as the polite suit and tie negotiators or the angry activists, not really knowing that in some cases they're the same people just under different guises. Mm-hmm. And so they began to negotiate and to say that whatever criteria they used for other minority groups, they would apply to gay people. It took much longer to get that same degree of concession around trans characters and bi characters.
So is it even possible to compare the environment that we were in a couple decades ago to today, where it seems like a lot of queer creators are just like able to finally tell their own stories? Like are those two worlds even comparable? They seem so completely different.
So where I ended the book when I wrote it in 2000 was with the prediction that when internet service became fast enough to support streaming full quality video, everything was going to change. And it really has, right? If you think about the era we were talking about before, the 70s, the 80s, the early 90s, there were three or four commercial networks that controlled most media content, and there were a couple of major cable players. But there was not the multiplicity of sources that we have now. So what it meant was, you know, back when you only had three networks, they had to worry about maximizing audience. You couldn't narrowcast. You needed to reach a general public. And now, with all these different platforms and specialized channels, and, you know, first with the rise of cable and then later with the rise of streaming platforms, you can go for a niche audience, and that's fine. So now that has changed. And there is less riding on each individual portrayal. Right. You can have a killer lesbian because not all the other lesbian characters are killer lesbians. Right. You know, it's sort of like what happened. Again, the specifics are different, but sort of if you look at the evolution of black characters on TV, the problem in the 50s wasn't that Amos and Andy existed. It wasn't that Beulah existed. It was that nothing else existed. Mm-hmm. Right. If you had had a whole range of black characters and then also those characters might not have been so bad. But that's all there was. And it's the same thing in the 70s with queer characters. There were so few of them and there were so few platforms that a lot was riding on each and every one. Now it doesn't matter as much.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, on one hand, it seems a little weird to say, like, finally, we can have the lesbian serial killers. But, you know, it is nice to see, like, just the breadth of queer representation that we can experience today.
Exactly. And now you're starting to get the first non-binary characters who are seen on an ongoing basis, shows like Billions. So yeah, there's a lot changing, which is good, I think, because what television gives us, and this is less important now because there's also the internet, so there's other sources of information. But one of the things that television gives us is a view of what's possible. And for young people especially who are just, you know, coming into their identities and figuring out their place in the world, it's good to be able to look at the screen and see somebody and say, oh, that's somebody like me. I could possibly do that.
Mm. Is there stuff that you watch now that's just purely for enjoyment? It seems like so much of your media diet is research and work, but what are the things that are just like the comforts that you look forward to just for your own enjoyment?
I have to admit, I am quite hooked on Roswell, New Mexico.
Okay.
Enjoy that show immensely. I had enjoyed the original Roswell series. I'm enjoying this one. And, I didn't used to be into like the supernatural and superhero shows, but I'm really enjoying Batwoman. Hmm. I think it's fantastic. But also, you know, my partner and I just watched Unorthodox. We're about a season and a half into Stissel, you know, so we're watching a range of things. But yeah, in terms of queer content, I'm really impressed with a lot of what's going on. And there's talk that there's, I think, going to be another season of Pose, which is kind of exciting because I had thought that was done.
Mm. Yeah, you know, that's a great one because you can simultaneously enjoy it as like a contemporary piece of television, but also there's so many connections to life of the 1980s. And, you know, of course, through Paris is Burning, but it really takes you back to another time.
And it's one of the few series I've seen that really deals with the AIDS crisis in a way that feels a little bit like what the AIDS crisis felt like.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting way to think of it. So if folks want to check out your book and see more about your lectures and everything, where should they go?
So the book is called Alternate Channels, Queer Images on 20th Century TV. They can find that on just about any bookselling platform. It's available in ebook. It's available as a paperback. On Twitter, I am Stephen Capsuto at StevenCapsuto. That's the best place to follow me. And my website is alternatechannels.net.
Fantastic. Well, Stephen, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Stephen for joining me. Definitely check out his book, Alternate Channels. It's the first thing I consult whenever I'm working on one of my YouTube videos. And on the topic of my YouTubes, if I may, I'd like to recommend my latest Culture Cruise video this week. As you might know, Culture Cruise is my YouTube series where I dive into the history around LGBTQ milestones from TV and film, and this month I'm taking a look back at the 1967 documentary The Queen, which captured not only a little slice of the reality of gay life in the 60s, but also a pivotal confrontation that helped lead to the creation of New York's ballroom scene, as captured 20 years later in Paris is Burning. In my Culture Cruise video, I track the history of New York drag balls back to the 1860s, then up through their evolution to the present day with shows like Pose. It's an amazing century and a half of history, and you can find the Culture Cruise video by searching for Culture Cruise on YouTube, or check out my Patreon, where members get access to an ad-free version. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Patreon backers get rewards like stickers in the mail, a copy of my book Defining Marriage, and also exclusive access to the Patreon-only podcast, Cozy Pants, in which I chat with my partner James about the entertainment that's bringing us joy right now. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get access to those benefits. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next live stream on June 6th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Also, check out my other podcasts, Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag queens on epic fantasy adventures. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comtech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.